I believe it was 2 weeks ago, Wes started chapter 7. Do you guys still remember it? It was a long time ago, wasn't it? We're going to read the first 14. We're only going to get through verse 14 tonight. I want to finish the rest of the chapter next week, next Sunday. But before we read these first 14 verses, I'm sure Wes explained to you that we are now moving into an entirely different type of writing as we move into chapters 7 through 12. Do you remember what this type of writing is called? Do you remember that it's called apocalyptic? Apocalyptic? Does anybody remember what apocalyptic means or is? It's actually a type of writing that came in to vogue maybe a couple of centuries before Christ was born. And, I mean, really in vogue, but obviously it was used prior to that. Daniel is an example. The book of Zechariah is another example of apocalyptic. The features of apocalyptic is a type of prophecy, a type of prophetic writing. Okay? So all apocalyptic literature is prophecy, but not all prophecy is apocalyptic. Apocalyptic is highly symbolic. It uses very symbolic images. And it's not just, the main purpose of apocalyptic isn't just to predict things. Okay, the main drive behind apocalyptic literature is to encourage God's people. Okay? So the writer uses lots of imagery, graphic, symbolic imagery to communicate what's happening in the future in order to encourage God's people that God is in control and that sort of thing. So that's what apocalyptic literature is. I don't know if you've noticed before in this notebook, in this workbook, or any of these workbooks, when you're reading through, if it has a footnote. Have you ever seen the footnotes in here? Those like a 1, 2, 3 or so kind of superscript, kind of up at the top, at the end of the word, up at the top of the last letter, there'd be a number that's a footnote. And in this series of workbooks, those footnotes are used to define words. Okay, so for instance, if you look at the very beginning of this chapter, page, what is it, 59, the author writes, Daniel 7 marks a significant transition in the book. This and the subsequent chapters, so 7 through 12, describe Daniel's visions of the future. Far from being mere apocalyptic speculation, in other words, Daniel wasn't just using a lot of symbolic imagery to speculate about the future. Secular writers did, but Daniel wasn't. The author says, far from being mere apocalyptic speculation, however, these visions are intended to encourage God's people in the midst of their exile. Notice the word apocalyptic. Okay? Notice at the end of the word, the number one there that appears above the sea. Do you see that? That's the footnote. Now, if you go to the end of this chapter in the workbook, page 66, you'll see the footnotes. This chapter has more footnotes than any of the six previous chapters did. It means that he's defining a lot of things, and he defines apocalyptic for you. Okay, and in the way he describes apocalyptic writing this way: the distinctive literary form of the book of Revelation and of chapters 7 through 12 of Daniel. And many also put Zechariah, the visions of Zechariah, in this same genre, apocalyptic. These parts of Scripture include revelation about the future, highly symbolic imagery, and the underlying belief that God Himself will one day end the world in its present form and establish His kingdom on earth. Apocalyptic is a mode of prophecy designed to encourage and support God's people through hard times. Okay? So isn't it interesting that some of these prophets, when they switch, like Daniel and Zechariah, and John in the book of Revelation, they switch to this highly symbolic imagery to depict God being in control, being triumphantly in control. He will win, and thereby encouraging God's people during hard times. Okay? Just keep going over it in your mind, okay? Just keep reading that definition and going over it in your mind. Probably about the 20th time it'll stick. You know, I've had a few years on you going over this. it'll stick. Just think, it's a type of prophecy. All apocalyptic literature is prophecy, but not all prophecy is apocalyptic. Apocalyptic uses a lot of symbolism and imagery. And its main concern is to encourage God's people that God is triumphantly in control so that they would be encouraged during hard times. And so that's the type of visions. That's the way Daniel wrote his visions in chapters 7 through 12. But it's also, even though it's meant to encourage us and depict how God is graphically, grab your imagination and depict how God is in control and He will win, so be encouraged. A lot of times when we get to this, like the second half of Daniel or much of the book of Zechariah or Revelation 6 through 20, we just many times will throw up our hands and say, I don't understand. I'm going to go read something I do understand, right? Well, let me just ask this question so as maybe it can give you a little bit more patience with apocalyptic literature. And that is, why do you suppose prophets like Zechariah and Daniel and John would switch to using highly symbolic imagery? I mean, think about Revelation, just all of the graphic imagery that's there. And we see that in Daniel, don't we? And if you read the book, you go home and this week read the book of Zechariah and see all of the imagery that's used there. Why do you think the prophets, some of these prophets, would switch to using that kind of writing? Let me approach it this way. What effect does it have on you when something is very graphic? Put aside the fact that this imagery is symbolic, and so where we're lost is trying to find the meaning of the symbolism. Let's set that issue aside for a moment, okay? And just think of it this way. When you read something that uses all of this graphic and imaginative imagery that the book of Revelation uses, or Daniel uses, even in these first eight verses of Daniel 7, or the imagery that we'll see in Daniel 8 and Daniel 10 through 12, what kind of effect does it have on you when an author uses real graphic, imaginative imagery? What kind of impact does it have on you? Yeah. It stays with you. It grabs your imagination. Now, say that again? What? Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. So this graphic imagery, it grabs your imagination and stays with you. It has a powerful impact on you. Now, that's not the reason why we don't gravitate to reading that type of literature. The reason we don't gravitate toward it is because we don't understand its symbolism, right? We don't know what these images symbolize. But my goodness, you just think about it. The four horsemen in the book of Revelation, has that been used in culture over the centuries? I mean, even in football, in Notre Dame history, they refer to the four horsemen. I mean, that type of imagery grabs people's imagination and they use it for all kinds of things. You could probably read through the book of Revelation and take a pen and paper and just start scribbling down, you know, especially chapters 6 through 12, but even some in the first five chapters, start scribbling down images that you know you've read or seen or heard in your lifetime growing up completely divorced from the Bible, right? That it's just imagery that somebody has used because it grabs your attention. So that's what Daniel's doing in these visions as he's writing it. He's writing it in such a way to grab your attention and put implant images in your mind that will stick with you. Now, why does he want to do that? What's the intention of apocalyptic literature? What's the writer trying to do for the people that he's writing to? To encourage them. So you write in a graphic, imaginative way that's going to stick with people, put images in your head, in their heads. And what's behind those images is meant to encourage them. That means you're trying to give them encouragement that they can't forget, right? That is a very good reason and motivation for working hard at understanding what Daniel and Zechariah and John mean behind that imagery. Because that imagery is going to stick in your brain no matter what. And if we work at understanding the meaning behind it, what he's trying to get across here with these images, then we've got an image in our head that's stuck there that we have a hard time getting rid of, and we know the message behind that image. And if it's a message of encouragement, then it just sticks with you. Do you see Daniel's method to his madness of using this type of literature? I mean, I can remember when I first started reading Revelation and Daniel and Zechariah thinking, who in the world even thought of this kind of approach? Why would they use this? Wouldn't it just be better to tell me straight out rather than using apocalyptic literature? Well, there's a reason. There's a method to the madness. Okay? Anyway, that's my pitch for being patient with the second half of Daniel, the book of Zechariah, and the book of Revelation. Is, nah, God didn't write it, have it written in such a way that only a few could understand. He really did mean to encourage you and I in these highly symbolic, graphic visions. And he wrote, had it written that way so it would stick in your brain. And you have encouragement stuck in you. Okay? All righty. I'll get down off that soap opera. Soapbox. Soap opera? Now, I just want to ask you a couple of things from 2 weeks ago. Since it's been 2 weeks, just want to ask you a couple of things. Remember the very first question on page 60. The author says, note that the vision Daniel receives in this chapter, and I would add chapter 8 as well. We'll see that in just a moment. Note that the vision Daniel receives in this chapter takes place during the first year of Belshazzar's reign. Chapter 8 takes place in the third year of Belshazzar's reign. So the events of both this chapter and chapter 8 are chronologically prior to the events of chapters 5 and 6. Why do you think this chapter and the next appear here rather than before chapter 5? Did you guys talk about that 2 weeks ago? Or is it just a matter that it's been 2 weeks ago? Oh, okay. Nerupa. Yes. Yes. Only there's a little twist here. And this gets into the details of how Daniel structured his book. Chapter 7 is still in Aramaic. Chapter 1 and chapters 8 through 12 are in Hebrew. Chapters 2 through 7 are in Aramaic. Aramaic is the universal business language of the Babylonian and Persian empires. So 2 through 7, even this first vision of this chapter 7 would have been understood, as far as the language anyway, by unbelievers as well. But yes, I think here's what's going on. Remember, go back to what apocalyptic literature is. And not even just apocalyptic literature, but the fact that these are prophetic visions given to Daniel about the future. These visions are meant to show us, to teach us and show us how God is in control. Triumphantly in control, right? So how that means, if it's written to people who are in exile and suffering, how much stock can they put in that? Oh, yeah, I know. Eventually we're going to win, right. Yeah, it sure doesn't look like it. So if you think about it that way, what does chapters 1 through 6 do for us? These are historical highlights of over 70 years of Daniel and his three friends' career in Babylon and Persia. Why do you suppose Daniel selected those incidences, those historical events in chapters 1 through 6? What is that supposed to do for us? Oh, okay, yeah. They definitely show that God is in control, right? He was in control of what's going to happen to these four youths that were brought in captivity in chapter 1. And then think of it, chapter 2, 3, 4, and 5. God definitely, and chapter 6, he starts doing things in their lives that are miraculous, and that humbles kings and protects his people in mind-blowing, miraculous ways. And so this is something that's happened already, and it's undeniable, and it's some of the greatest miracles to happen outside of the incarnation and the resurrection. Okay, actually, you all are examples of great miracles too. Regeneration. We were dead and then we were made alive. But remember, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, there was not even the smell of smoke on them. And you talk to any fireman, and that's the hardest thing to get rid of. And they didn't even have the smell of smoke on them. Daniel, I don't know how many lions were in that pit, but the mouths of all of them were shut. And we see how powerful and voraciously hungry they were when Daniel's lifted out and his accusers and their families are thrown in. They don't even reach the bottom of the pit before they're torn to shreds by those lions. Those are incredible miracles. Think of chapter 2, the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had. What was the demand that he placed on his wise men? Remember the... Yes. Exactly. And obviously, they were beside themselves. That's unreasonable. No king has ever asked any wise man to do that. He still wanted it. Daniel was able to do that. So you start putting those things together, and you think how God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. You know, put him down on all fours, eating grass and out of his mind. You see how he humbled Belshazzar. So that's only a half a dozen events in their lives. Half a dozen events out of over 70 years of life in Babylon and Persia. Okay? But those were uniquely, specifically selected to show how undeniably God is triumphantly in control of this situation and protects his people. Doesn't mean you're not going to face death. That's the thing that we saw in chapter 3 with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? God, our God, can deliver us. But even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow down to your image. We're going to worship our God. But obviously God did deliver them. Okay? So those events show undeniably that God is in control. Now, in the second half of the book, we get into the visions of Daniel. And we have a lot more reason to have confidence that God is triumphantly in control. We've seen it in the past. Now he's telling us how he's going to do it in the future. The Jews in exile, they saw it in their day. And so they are much more prepared to believe Daniel when he tells us what God will do in the future in those visions. So does that make sense? And that's why 7 and 8 occur after 5 and 6, even though they were dated before 5 and 6. Remember, chapter 5 is where Belshazzar is killed by the Persians, right? Chapter 7 occurred in the first year of Belshazzar. Chapter 6 occurred in the third year of Belshazzar. Chapter 5 is when Belshazzar dies. Chapter 6 is the first year of the Persian king. Okay? So, 1 through 6 are in chronological order. 7 through 12 are in chronological order. It's just that 7 occurs before 5 and 6. But that's not the way he did it in his book. He wanted to give us the historical reason to trust the power and wisdom and sovereignty of God before telling us how God is going to bring things to an end in the future in chapter 7 in his four visions. Chapters 10 through 12 is one vision. We'll see when we get there. Okay? Does it make sense? Okay. Now, let's read verses 1 through 14, and then we'll do as much of questions 2 and 3 as we can do. Starting in verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, arise, devour much flesh. After this, I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little horn, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by its roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000, which is 10 to the 8th, okay, just in case you were wondering, stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. And I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Okay. That's the first 14 verses. Wes told me that you guys went through the first 8 verses, so you did that question 1. So we'll start with question 2, the Ancient of Days judges the beast, verses 9 through 12. So he's got 9 through 14 divided up into 2 sections. And that's the way a lot of people divide it up. But we're going to look at something. We're going to look at something in just a moment. But first, I want to consider his questions here. He says, verse 9 marks a change of scene. Moving from the stormy seashore setting of verses 1 through 8 to an altogether different setting. How would you describe this new setting? That's the first question. The second question is, what does the juxtaposition, that is the butting up together of these two very different scenes, communicate? What does that communicate? So first, the first question, how would you describe this new setting in verses verses 9 through 14, but he has in particular verses 9 through 12. And I have a feeling he has particularly in mind verses 9 and 10. So how does 9 through 14, how does this new setting, how would you describe it? He described that first setting, verses 1 through 8, as a stormy seashore setting. How would you describe the setting in verses 9 through 14? Nick. So you see, in verses 9 through 14, you see order and calmness and peace versus the stormy chaos of the first 8 verses. Yeah, good. Ah, you're doing both studies, aren't you? Ah, yes. You're talking about in the throne room of God. Did I disconnect myself? Okay, good. Well, Wes broke the other one a couple of weeks ago. I don't want to break the brand new one. Yeah. So you were contrasting the two seas in Revelation when it depicts the beast come in Revelation 13 coming out of the sea. It's a stormy, chaotic sea, whereas in Revelation 21 and 22, in the scene in heaven or in the throne room, it's a sea of glass. So it's not stormy and chaotic and all of that. Reminded you of. Okay. Anybody else? Nayrupa, did you have your hand up? Calm. Yes. Very good. Any, Deepak. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's in control. Right. Exactly. That's and I think you're knocking at the door of the answer to that second question with that observation. Deepak said that in the first 8 verses, the stormy seashore setting, you saw an outside force operating on and therefore controlling the beasts. Like, for instance, the first beast, its wings were plucked and it was stood up like a man. Okay? But he says in verses 9 through 14, the Ancient of Days is in control. There's nobody controlling him. Yes, all very good observations. And I didn't write down any of them. I wrote down a throne and judgment scene. But you guys are all right. I should add that to mine. A throne and judgment scene. But in that throne and judgment scene, it was calm. There was order. And then to get to Deepak's observation, that second question. What does putting together side by side, that's what he means by juxtaposition. Putting together side by side the scene in the first 8 verses with the scene in verses 9 through 14. What, putting those right together so we can see the contrast, and we've been discussing the contrast. What is that contrast supposed to communicate to us? Or let me put it this way. That's in absolute terms, isn't it? What does that contrast communicate to you? What did you put? I'm sure what you've got written down is fine. Nirupa. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kind of like Revelation 20. The dead were resurrected and the books were opened and they were judged from the books and they were dealt with accordingly. Yes. Yes. But what does that tell us? Think of what Deepak said. In the first 8 verses, the beasts in some way were being acted upon by some higher authority. The higher authority isn't named. And all of a sudden, pardon? The Ancient of Days is in control. I think what Daniel's trying to get at here is by putting these two scenes side by side with each other, he is graphically depicting where the glory and power, the justice and the kingship really resides. None of those beasts, right? Even the most horrible beast, the fourth one, that was stronger than all of them and was trampling everything. They had dominion for a while, right? They had kingship for a while. And they had a man-made glory for a while. And they had a certain amount of power for a while. But the Ancient of Days is where, and in his throne room, that's where the real glory and power and justice and kingship reside, isn't it? It's a great depiction, the way he's doing that. Do you see how vivid imagery can be used to paint a real graphic picture? And if we work hard enough and get the meaning behind the imagery, it's something that can just stick in our brain right there. And we just worked hard and we just got the meaning of what Daniel's doing here. He's trying to show us that it is a beast-eat-beast world. and it's chaotic. And they have to fight and grab for the power they get. But there is a God in heaven who has the real glory, the real power, the real kingship. And he's not frantic. He's not wringing his hands. He is calm, orderly. He's mad. But he's mad at their sin. He's mad at the defiant sinners and their sin. And what does he do? Does he get on Twitter and just tell them how stupid they are? No. You know, some rulers do that. Leave it at that. What God does is he calls the court in session and he opens the books and judges from them and metes out the judgment. So anyway, just seeing that picture can just stick in your brain. Okay, so now, the next part of section 2, he says, at the center of this scene, wait a minute, did anybody else have anything else to add? That's right, Nick was trying to...
So when he describes Daniel Okay.
Yeah. Instead of using the imagery of a chaotic seashore setting and seeing these four beasts rise out of it? Well, I'm sure he could. Isaiah did. Jeremiah did. They just said, Isaiah just told him, Assyria is going to come and get you. And then they also, both of them said, and then Babylon's going to come and get you. Right. Right. But the point here, we, the church, are in a similar situation that Israel and Judah, or the entire nation of Israel, was in captivity, in exile. All right? And so you can compare Revelation to Daniel. The purposes are the same. We are people in exile, and just like there have been rulers that have tried to wear out the saints. I mean, that's such an expression that sticks with me here in Daniel. That the horns tries to persecute and wear out the saints of the Most High. Just think about that. Just think about one of the most powerful people in the world has as his goal in front of him to wear you down because you belong to Christ. We're in that situation. That's what Revelation tells us about. God's people, Israel, was in that situation in exile. And so we've already got other promises that we know Jesus is going to win. Okay? Jesus told us that. The Old Testament prophets told us that. But in Daniel and Revelation, what we have is two prophets who have targeted the people of God who are in exile, who are being persecuted, and they want to encourage us that God is triumphantly in control. And so they go to this type of writing, apocalyptic literature, this type of writing to grab our attention and to sear images into our minds and hearts.
And it's crazy that, like you say, like, people read it today.
Yes.
And then they, like,
misinterpret
the whole thing.
Yes.
Like, you know, media,
right.
You know, I don't understand
Yeah, like, I don't think that the locusts in Revelation are Black Hawk attack helicopters, you know. Oh, yeah. Late Great Planet Earth. Yeah, they didn't know what a helicopter is, so they were just describing as best. No, they were using highly symbolic language, images, for the express purpose of searing that into your mind. We work hard to try and understand what the symbolism is. The image is there. We work hard to try to understand what the symbolism there, what the symbolism means. And then we've got an image that we hang that meaning on, right? And that image is emblazoned in the Isles of Langerhorne up here. And so we, you know, I think that's what Daniel and John are trying to accomplish here, a way of encouraging us. So, and in the course, of Scripture, there are various images that are used, and so the biblical authors will pick them up and continue using. For instance, this next question, at the center of this scene is the Ancient of Days. How is he described, and what is this meant to convey about his character and purpose? So there's things here that are used to describe the Ancient of Days that are meant to convey to us something about his character and his action and his purposes. And some of these images are used throughout the Bible. I'll tell you one in a minute, but first I'm going to let you answer the question. Two questions here. First, how is the Ancient of Days described? And secondly, what is that description meant to convey about his character and purposes? So first of all, how is he described? What did you write down there? You know, plagiarizing Daniel was okay too. Oh, that's right. It gets recorded. Ay, Chihuahua. His clothing is like snow. Yeah. There's one before clothing and hair. Ancient of Days. Yeah, he's called ancient. He's called Ancient of Days. And his clothing is white as snow. Yeah. And we'll get to that in just a moment. In that second question, what does that mean? What does that convey to us? But how else is he described? Is he sitting in a chaise lounge? Yeah, throne of fiery flames with a stream of fire flowing from it. Pardon? We're burning fire, yeah. Yep, burning fire. Okay, so now the next question. Now that we've seen the description, what is that description meant to convey to us about him? Righteousness. What implies that to you? Like the righteous part. What? And where do you get that from? Pure. Yes, clothing, white as snow. Yes, exactly. His purity and righteousness. Absolutely great.
That's just crazy because it's just like he has this fire and like all these things. And like fire to me is like chaos, you know, wildfire, chaos.
And actually, when you read through the Bible, it's used to depict what?
Yeah.
Yes. Power and even anger. Okay? Why do they call him Ancient of Days? Are they trying to depict him as a frail old man? Why Ancient of Days? Everlasting? Yes, everlasting. He's been around a long time. Notice again, he's placing these two pictures side by side. This stormy, chaotic seashore picture where a beast is coming out, then another one comes out and eats that beast. It's a beast-eat-beast world. And yet, then right next to it, the Ancient of Days takes his seat. It implies he's been around a lot longer than those beasts. Everlasting, yes. So it's not meant to convey frailty. It's meant to convey everlastingness. He's been around. What is the description of his hair meant to convey? Remember, it says he's got a head of hair like pure wool. So that's what? White. His hair is white. You know, I recently, well, within the last 2 or 3 years, reconnected on Facebook with some of my high school buddies. I went to high school in Missouri. First time I saw them, their pictures on Facebook, it's like, who are these guys? I knew them as, you know, sophomores, juniors, seniors, and all of that. And they're just a bunch of men with white heads, you know, and beards. And it was shocking. I squinted to try to see the teenage boy in them that I knew, and all of that. What does white hair imply? Yes, wisdom. Wisdom. With age comes wisdom, right? So if any of you have the ESV Study Bible, I like what the guy writes down there, what this overall picture is supposed to convey. He says, well, first of all, before we do that, we already said the fire implies power, pictures power, and maybe even anger. Okay, listen to what this guy says. And he's not the only one to say it, but some of you have ESV Study Bibles, and so I just wanted to affirm what this guy says in the footnote here. He says, this scene depicts in powerful imagery a judge who has the wisdom to sort out right from wrong, the purity to persistently choose the right, and the power to enforce his judgments. And then, so that's what that imagery is supposed to imply. So now when you think on that image, that's what's going to come to your mind. The image is already there, right? Now you've got a meaning to hang on it. And so whenever you remember that image, that meaning can come rushing back into your head. And isn't it encouraging to know that our Father, our spiritual Father, is one who has the wisdom to sort out right from wrong, the purity to always choose the right, and the power to enforce it. I mean, that's I love the very first question of the catechism. What is our only hope in life and death? I mean, just, you know, say that, recite that to yourself many times, over and over. Recite it dramatically to yourself. What is my only hope in life and death? That I, what are our only hope in life and death? That That, say that again. That's right. Any other time I could have given it, but put me on the spot. That I am not my own, but I belong to God. I belong to the Ancient of Days. Isn't that encouraging? And yes. 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 Did you hear what Jan said? Jan said, think about the legal process, how it's been destroyed in the news and all of the social media and all of that. And then compare that with this picture here. Encouraging that we know the judge who is wise beyond all measure. He will sort everything out. He is pure and righteous. He will always do the right thing. And he is omnipotent and sovereign. He will enforce. He's got the power to enforce his right judgments. That's encouraging. I'd like to move on to the next question, but it's five after, so we should probably stop right there and take up here next week.